Welcome, everyone. My name is Ted Pappas. This is PS311, peptic ulcer disease. I'm encouraged by the crowd. I think it's going to get larger. This is a session that if you're taking general surgery call, people still have passion about peptic ulcer disease, because although we don't see it during the daytime hours all that much, we certainly see it at 2 a.m. sometimes, some of the complications. So thanks for joining us, and we'll get right into the meat of the matter. So there'll be three talks, each about 20 minutes. We're going to save questions until the end, and I'm hoping we'll have about 30 minutes to answer some questions. So write down your questions and save them for that. So our first speaker is Ken Sharp. Ken is the professor of surgery and vice chair of the Department of Surgery at Vanderbilt, and he's going to be talking about perforation and obstruction in peptic ulcer disease. Dr. Sharp.
Okay, thank you, Ted. As far as disclosures, I have no financial disclosures except for this. So I have a conflict in the sense that there is so little good data in the management of bleeding, obstructed, and perforated ulcer disease that this is going to be a heavily opinionated talk. And I just need to put this slide up to show you who influenced me. When I joined the staff at Vanderbilt in 1984, H. William Scott and John Sawyers were giants internationally in the field of peptic ulcer surgery. And I'm heavily influenced by their teaching to me. So beware, there's not a whole lot of data coming. So complicated peptic ulcer disease remains a fairly serious problem. It does seem to have a predilection for nighttime presentation. It is somewhat decreasing in incidence. There is one little bit of data here, a fairly old paper from 2010 reviewing hospitalization for complicated ulcer disease. 73% of the patients were admitted for hemorrhage. Perforation accounted for 9% of people with complicated ulcer disease, and obstruction 3%. They looked at this that between 1993 and 2010, the incidence of hospitalization for duodenal ulcer decreased by 37%, but only 20% for gastric ulcer. Now, if we were to take that back to 1963, the decrease would have been dramatically greater. The use of vagotomy or gastric resection in the treatment of complicated ulcer disease in 2010 fell to approximately 3% of patients presenting with those complications. It remains a very mortal process. If you have a perforated ulcer, your mortality is in the 25% range. And for bleeding, 30-day mortality is about 9%. And as everybody would understand, your risk of mortality increases with age, the presence or absence of H. pylori infection, the use of non-steroidals, and probably smoking. Yep. So, I don't think you really want to hear a lot about the presentation and clinical presentation, because if there's somebody in this audience that doesn't know it, we got a problem. It is about a 4 to 14 per 100,000 population incidence. In my metropolitan area of Nashville, that accounts for some 300 patients per year presenting to our hospital systems. But in any case, pain, peritonitis, it is important to get a history of smoking, NSAID use, et cetera. Early and late presentation is also key in the management of these patients. Patients with early presentation are going to do far better. Those with late presentation will do far worse. And so the duration of symptoms is an important part in your assessment of the patient. Tachycardia is almost always present. Hypotension may be. But probably, again, the other key thing on the physical exam is generalized or localized peritonitis, which will be part of your decision making in how to manage these patients. The presence of shock, poor perfusion, altered mental status is a very ominous presenting sign. I think is there somebody in the audience who has not seen this? Raise your hand. Okay, good. This is a case I did a year or two ago. It was a burn patient, had been a young man injured in a meth explosion in his trailer, who 3 days after presentation for his burn developed severe abdominal pain, The intern in the burn unit got a chest x-ray and saw free air. I was called to see the patient, and he had generalized peritonitis, and we simply took him onto the operating room after a brief period of resuscitation. He was actually already very well resuscitated. And here we have a post-pyloric, I guess I can use this as a pointer, yes? Yeah. Pylorus and a little post-pyloric duodenal ulcer perforation measuring about 5 to 7 millimeters. So, as you're called to evaluate these patients, you're going to find that they have a leukocytosis. There may or may not be anemic. The presence of acute kidney injury is extremely common and obviously becomes more prominent with the delay in presentation or delay in or presentation of a delayed perforation. Now, in my emergency room, chest x-rays are fairly rarely done. Abdominal x-rays are fairly rarely done. And when somebody has abdominal pain, just before the vital signs are taken, just before an intake history is taken, they get a CT scan. But I do teach my residents that if you get a chest x-ray or an abdominal film, you see free air, and the patient has peritonitis, has shock, resuscitate and go to the operating room. You may or may not really need further information in that patient, especially the patient who has a history of NSAID use, steroids, smoking, or a history of peptic ulcer disease in the past. You may not need that CT scan. CT scans in my emergency room are usually done without oral contrast. They may help you in some ways in the sense that they do detect free air much more sensitively than a chest x-ray does. You may well see some bowel wall thickening or bowel wall edema, mesenteric edema in the area of the perforation, which may guide you to the area that it's a duodenal or a gastric ulcer perforation. Or you may see thickening in the sigmoid colon with stranding and edema and make you think, well, that's not a perforated peptic ulcer. It's a perforated colon. Now, I find that CT scans with oral contrast are very helpful. Even to the point where I've occasionally repeated a CT scan with oral contrast after seeing one of these patients, because if they extravasate contrast, that heavily determines my operative course, or excuse me, my surgical management of the patient. So I think that that's a very helpful adjunct in these patients. So first priority, resuscitation. John Sawyers told me, rushing the patient, an hour spent in resuscitation will do you far better than 2 days of post-operative misery in the ICU. So a perforated peptic ulcer is not a level one trauma case. We're not there to stop the bleeding. We've got to get the patient resuscitated and then treat appropriately. IV antibiotics, well, I'm not going to give an antibiotic lecture, but certainly ampicillin, sulbactam, third generation cephalosporins, carbapenems, all are very useful. There is no good data to show you that use of antifungals empirically helps or hurts. My prejudice is to use them, especially in the elderly who have a lot of candida in their stomach. But I am not here to tell you there's any data. How about immediate PPIs? Now I think this is an interesting topic, because as I don't know whether Stan is going to cover this much, but there are a lot of people who feel that when you have somebody with a duodenal ulcer bleeding, there actually is some pretty good data that prompt use of high-dose intravenous PPIs will actually help slow or stop the bleeding. And there's an opinion held by many authors that prompt and high-dose use of PPIs in perforated peptic ulcer disease is also useful in wound healing. Now, I can't tell you I can explain that, but if you choose to use high-dose intravenous PPIs on presentation, I'll never criticize you. Now, I was taught, in the last 30 years since we've discovered H. pylori in the 80s, that when you operate on these patients, you should biopsy the ulcer to look for H. pylori. And that intuitively just didn't feel right. I was going to cut a piece of an ulcer out and make it bigger. There is no rush to diagnose H. pylori in the emergency room or in the operating room. The ideal treatment for H. pylori is actually oral antibiotics, not IV antibiotics. So there's no rush. You don't need to worry about, well, if you've got the serology pending on H. pylori, it is not pertinent to the emergency room or early management of these patients. Now, clearly when I started my faculty position, anybody who had a perforated peptic ulcers who had free air went to the operating room. There was no question, there was no thinking. We just said, there's free air, we gotta go. Well, we ignored the data that had been developed in treatment of people in Antarctica and in remote mountainous locations who had been treated with antibiotics with some success over the years, but those were largely anecdotal response. So here are factors, and notice I probably should have put favoring in caps, because this is an opinion, this is favoring, this is not data. But if you want to consider an urgent operation, well, it's pretty clear cut. In my mind, patient with generalized peritonitis, probably patient with shock, hypotension, are properly resuscitated and then operated on. But clearly, generalized peritonitis, to me, is a ticket to the operating room. Now, 25 years ago, we started looking at, well, if it's a contained perforation, maybe that patient can be managed medically. Can we just give them antibiotics, drain their stomach, and see how they do, frequent serial exams, et cetera. And we gave an upper GI, we gave those patients an upper GI with water-soluble contrast to look for extravasation as one of the criteria for considering non-operative versus operative intervention. Nowadays, I think that a CT scan with oral contrast is the way that gives you more information. So in my opinion, this is superior to an upper GI series to look for free extravasation. That, in my book, is a ticket to the operating room. Factors that you can use in considering non-operative treatment would be the patient who has stable hemodynamics upon presentation, or the patient who has rapid stabilization with resuscitation. They have mild or limited peritonitis. They don't have extravasation of oral contrast on upper GI or on CT scan. And then, very importantly, the ability to carefully monitor those patients, probably in an ICU, so they can be monitored for increasing tachycardia, decreasing blood pressure. They can be assessed for urine output, but you also need to have frequent clinical exams. And if that's not possible, that's probably not a good treatment for those patients, because somewhere between 10 and 40% of those patients will fail non-operative management, and it's a little hard to predict who those are and when it will occur. But John Sawyers taught me that if they have not responded well in 12 hours, that patient has failed non-operative treatment. And notice I don't say surgical treatment, I say non-operative treatment, but it's best done by a surgeon. How do we manage these? The classic Graham patch. Does anybody remember when that paper was written by Roscoe Graham? I had forgotten when it occurred. 1937 was when this was described, in which he described putting a plug of omentum in a perforated duodenal ulcer and securing it with sutures around the duodenum and the antrum. We'll talk about results a little bit later. But again, I would heavily advise you, don't try to suture the perforation shut. Friable tissue, you try to put some nice 3-0 silks in it, and it's going to saw through. You're going to make your tissue... you're going to make the situation worse. So put your omentum in and on and around the perforation and suture it in place into tissues that are not so friable. I personally am a believer in vigorous irrigation. I realize that's not either proven or data driven. The use of drains has been looked at, and in poor series doesn't really show a benefit. Now, if you're draining an abscess, I think drain helps. If you're draining generalized peritonitis, I think you're fooling yourself. And in the patient who has omentum that's either inadequate or it's immobile from previous surgical procedures with a lot of adhesions, then I think you can use the falciform ligament, where you just detach it from the anterior abdominal wall and turn it down over the perforation. And again, suture in place rather than trying to buttress a closure of the perforation. Definitive ulcer operations for perforation, rarely used now. We're probably at a level of 3% or less now. And that's obviously because we have a decreasing incidence in this era of PPIs, and we have put this politely, we have a lot of surgeons who have very little experience in gastric surgery these days. My residents now finish their residencies with one or two ulcer operations, which is frequently for perforation, but have not done formal anti-ulcer operations. Certainly a definitive ulcer operation should not be used in the frail patient, the supremely elderly, and the unstable patient. You want a quick operation to control the soilage and get out. Now, what about the patient who is not going to be able to get off their NSAIDs, or the patient who's going to be non-compliant with medications? Well, I think actually the NSAID patient, honestly, they're very unlikely to get off them. Now, in Tennessee, we have a lot of people using BC and Goody powders. Many of them may be able to get off of it, but when you've got the elderly arthritic patient, you're fooling yourself. I still probably would not do a definitive operation in the elderly on NSAIDs. But there are frequent patients who come with perforation who are homeless, they're uninsured, and they're not going to be able to afford long-term PPI therapy. Now, that's a pretty rare indication. But the first principle, as I already alluded to, do no harm. 2 a.m., after you've already done two appendectomies and a small bowel obstruction, is not the time to try your first vagotomy and enterectomy. If you aren't facile with gastric surgery, this is not the time to try to do it. Special situations, but again, first do no harm. If you have the patient who has combined hemorrhage and obstruction, then maybe a formal operation is going to be indicated. But remember, you can always come back later when the patient's stable or develops chronic symptoms. You can always come back later. First goal, make the patient survive. Giant duodenal ulcer perforation, and there are different definitions. Ulcer perforation is greater than 2 centimeters. Ulcer perforation is greater than 4 centimeters is the topic of an entire talk on its own. These are difficult, but in general, giant duodenal ulcers should be diverted so you generally will do an enterectomy and Billroth 2, et cetera. Closure of the duodenal stump, again, that's part of a much longer presentation. There are many different ways of putting in tubes and doing innovative techniques for closure of a difficult duodenal stump. Now, I alluded earlier to Dr. Graham's series. His publication in 1937, I think it's been a while since I've read this, but I think it was 50 or 60 patients, and he reported a 2% mortality. Modern mortality, 25%. Why was he so good? Patient selection. He didn't have ICUs, and if you were 75 years old and with severe heart failure, you need to present with perforation, you didn't get an operation. The complications, as you would imagine, leaks of Graham patches are not rare, 2 to 9% in several series. Intra-abdominal sepsis, abscesses, very common. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there is no class 1 data to show superiority of any of these approaches. There is a little bit of data emerging that laparoscopic intervention has equivalent or even slightly better outcome because of fewer wound issues and possibly a slightly different, slightly lower incidence of intra-abdominal sepsis. But most of those papers, even in the randomized controlled trials, had a fairly high patient selection bias to the younger and healthier patient. And I'm not a terribly facile laparoscopic surgeon, but I can suture a piece of omentum over a perforated duodenal ulcer. You don't need to be a laparoscopic guru. But remember that some of the older patients and the more cardiac frail patients will not tolerate insufflation. Now, perforated gastric ulcers, much less common than duodenal ulcer, so the data here is largely anecdotal or empirical. That's my opinion, ought to be yours too. Now, we do believe that you should biopsy the ulcer to assess for malignancy. Perforation of a gastric cancer has been very rare in my experience. Occasionally, some lymphoma patients who are being treated with chemo will perforate. But yeah, you gotta love the availability of frozen section at midnight. Okay, even at a university medical center, we don't have an in-house frozen section availability. And again, gastric ulcer disease that perforates is associated with a much higher mortality than perforated duodenal ulcers because the patient population is older, sicker, and frailer. I personally excise these ulcers in a non-stable patient and close them, trying to close through healthier tissue. Patches, in my experience, patching gastric ulcers has had a high incidence of re-leak. So John Sawyers and Bill Scott were emphatic that gastric ulcer perforations should be treated with gastric resection. That's their opinion, ought to be mine too. Gastric outlet obstruction, I'm going to cover this very briefly. It's generally duodenal ulcer disease or pyloric channel ulcer disease. We don't need to talk about the presentation extensively. Patients are dehydrated, they may be malnourished, and they do have, in the old days, very significant metabolic alkalosis, hypokalemia from long-standing vomiting of hydrochloric acid. In the chronic cases that you have that have been long-standing, the upper GI, so a large, dilated, sort of J-shaped stomach, CT scans, same thing. The problem with this is that occasionally it's very difficult to distinguish between malignancy and long-standing peptic ulcer disease. There are acute gastric outlet obstructions from acute, severe duodenal ulcer disease. And again, that's a historical factor for you to take into account. But they generally have more edema on the CT scan, and they usually have a shorter duration of symptoms. Decompression of the stomach, followed by endoscopy, assess for malignancy, but that's not often definitive, because if you have a terribly scarred pylorus, you really can't be sure there's not a distal duodenal cancer or a pancreatic head cancer. Acute obstructions, so if you see a lot of edema and fresh ulcerations, those often respond well to endoscopic dilatation. And some of the chronic, very fibrotic strictures will respond to dilatation, but there is a slightly higher incidence of perforation in the more chronic patient. So as I mentioned, how you treat these patients, IV PPIs here are very useful. Operative management, all I can say is wow, just wow. This is an hour-long talk in and of itself. And so if you thought I was opinionated with respect to perforated ulcer operations, you ain't heard nothing yet. I think one of the keys here is, remember, this is not an urgent or emergent situation. There's no urgent trip to the operating room indicated for these patients. If you decompress the stomach, correct their metabolic and electrolyte abnormalities, and you believe that it's a fairly chronic obstruction, nasogastric decompression, and you can go to the operating room reasonably promptly. But beware, if you have a greatly dilated stomach, resumption of gastric tone is going to be very slow, and delayed gastric emptying will be very common. If you wait for the stomach to shrink and prolonged nasogastric decompression, you pay for your prolonged hospitalization up front rather than after the end. Now, they got them in drainage, they got them in pyloroplasty, Heineken maculus, Finney, Jabalay. There's no data. If you operate on these patients, you kind of have to do what you know how to do, because nobody in this room, I suspect, has a series of 100 of these. I mean, I have a dozen in like 30 years. Vagotomy and antrectomy with Bill Roth 1, Bill Roth 2, root closure. Again, worrying about the difficult duodenal stump closure. Several times during my career running M&M at Vanderbilt, we've come across patients who had a gastric outlet obstruction treated with an antrectomy and Roux and Y reconstruction without vagotomy. And remember, that's a variant of the old Mann-Williamson animal prep to make marginal ulcers. So if you don't do a vagotomy, you're still gonna have significant acid secretion onto a Roux limb that has no bicarbonate protection. So there's no data I can quote to you here. Sometimes do what you know how to do, get consultation, get help, but don't do any harm. If you're not sure what to do, it's not an emergency situation. So we'll answer questions at the end of the session. Thank you.